Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I apologize for the rerun. I was actually supposed to air a constitutional course, or actually what I had kind of gone through and helped emphasize so that everybody could go through the Constitution. It should have been with Article 1, but that's not how what was played on Friday. But there's a good reason why I wasn't here, and I want you to know that I actually had a very productive meeting with the County Commissioner Association of Washington State, at least the Eastern Washington side. And I'm just letting you know, folks, the county association exists in every state, as far as I know, because these guys actually meet. Your county commissioners, there's actually a national association where they kind of meet with Western states and so forth. And so I find it interesting that, you know, they're as organized and they're cross-pollinating what they're doing. And I honestly think, and I don't know where all the funding comes, whether that actually just comes out of the state budget for them to be a part of this association, or there's money that goes into that. You know, it's like ALEC, A-E or A-L-E-C, which is a large-backed body, kind of like a lobbyist organization that, you know, works with congressmen and state legislatures and so forth. And most people consider ALEC a good conservative organization, but they're really not. They're out there trying to help promote good things for their business, and they claim good things for all businesses. But whenever government is opening the doors and listening to, especially the federal government, listening to corporations, they're not working on your behalf, because your behalf and their job, remember the two primary jobs, the two objects of why we form government, is to protect life and to protect personal property. Not necessarily, you know, this grand thing. It's kind of like the commandments, you know, how Christ boiled them down into two things. And so when they're meeting with corporations, the question is, how is it that they're protecting life and or your private property? 9 times out of 10, the compromise is your private property. And when I say your private property, I don't mean necessarily that acreage of land you may possess, that car and the tangible things, the physical things in your world. They tend to take your property in your liberties, because bottom line, folks, as Madison said, it may be said that a man has rights in his property. It can equally be said he has property in his rights. In other words, your right of speech, your right of conscience, you have property in that. So in other words, when they take away your ability to worship, when they take away your ability to do things, and maybe corporations are coming along and saying, you know, we want to help you, so we're going to provide you this type of thing so that people, so they can kind of do a little bit of what they need to do, you know, like plexiglass or, you know, or masks or what have you, and government mandates those things, and they make money. And they're all working together, and bottom line, the thing that gets lost, the thing that gets taken from you, is your liberties. Now, I'm going to go back down this trail that I kind of created, because I never did finish it. I just wanted to let you know kind of a paradigm of mine and why I want to give you the reason why I think this way, because if you understand, and if nobody has ever done this, if you've never looked up Dr. Duncan McDougall in Massachusetts, this is an interesting story, because in 1907, he basically theorized that the human body contains a soul and or spirit, and that spirit possibly has mass to it, therefore weight. And so this is basically his experiment. And actually, this was in 1901. He was a physician at Haverhill, Massachusetts, who wished to specifically determine if a soul had a weight. And he identified six patients in nursing homes whose deaths were imminent. And four were suffering from tuberculosis, one from diabetes, one from unspecified diseases. So that kind of gives you the layout. So he only had six patients. And so McDougall specifically chose people who were suffering from conditions that caused physical exhaustion, as he needed the patients to really remain still as they died to measure them accurately. Because, you know, if you're rocking on a scale, it kind of teeters back and forth. So when the patients looked like they were close to death, the entire bed was placed on an industrial-sized scale that was sensitive enough within 0.2 ounce, which is basically 5.6 grams, on the belief that humans had souls and that animals—and he was going down this path that animals really don't have souls. McDougall later started measuring the weights of dogs, you know, after their death or for their death and so forth. And there's some questions of what and why he did that and how. But the results were kind of clear. One of the patients lost but then put back on weight, and he couldn't understand that. And then two other patients registered loss, but a few minutes lost even more. One patient lost 0.75 ounce in weight. So in other words, there was a consistency that when a person expired, that they lost weight. And so as he kind of went down this path, you know, all of them, but he, as people analyzed it, he actually had one really solid test case. And that one test case is where he was able to analyze that he had, that this one soul, one patient lost 21.3 grams in weight, coinciding with the time of death. So as we kind of look at what he did, and I want you to look at 1901. 1901 was still, you know, people were very Christian. And there was not a big movement of Satanism and Luciferism and what we see today. But in academia, I have told you, and if you read my book, and if you go and study any kind of history, communism actually started infiltrating America. With the unions in the early 1800s, the communes of France, I mean, the communist revolution of 1790 in France basically was the beginning, and this is when the communists reared their head. I've also told you that in 1776, the communist manifesto, or I should say the charter, the plan to be executed by the communist movement, was written by Adam Weishaupt. And so that's, you know, I also expose, you know, if you look at 1776, two very significant documents were created for liberty. One was The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. The other one was a proclamation to the world on the Declaration of Independence. We were all created equal. In other words, the spirit of the Lord was really manifesting itself by these two pivotal documents that changed the course of the world for the free markets to be established, as well as individual liberty and individual sovereignty. So would you be surprised that Satan was going just as fast to work, and he basically laid out his plan to subjugate the world by this charter that Adam Weishaupt wrote. So anyway, as we started moving into the 19th century, the 1800s, we see that communism started coming in here with collective labor and those types of principles. By the mid-1800s, a gentleman, a southerner, who was also a professor, was huge in socialism, and communism was rearing its head in the softer form of socialism. And I think the guy's name was George Fitzhugh, I believe. This is in my book. But he basically postulated that all people would be better off if they were slaves, whites and blacks. It's, you know, only those who had the affluence and the education that could actually take care of these people. I mean, so he was actually telling people, going around saying, you know, most all of you should be slaves because you just don't know what's best for you. That was the paradigm that was being manifested of communism, that the elite people that had the ability to comprehend should be those who control those who can't, who are uneducated, who don't have the opportunity. And so as repugnant as all of this is, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to lay out how the controls were already getting and steeping into government and education. By the 1880s, the Fabian Society completely injected themselves into American Enlightenment and into our education system by a bunch of professors coming from England into America and going into Ivy schools. By 1906, I mean, they had established a nationwide movement in almost every college. Massachusetts was one of the first places they landed. They dug into in the 1880s. As a matter of fact, Teddy Roosevelt attended Harvard. He got his degree from Harvard, and his degree was a couple of years before the communist principles of economy, government, and those types of things were starting to be exposed. And he, as he heard this, he goes, "This is great." And he was upset that he didn't have the opportunity to learn these things because he was a tyrant. Most people look at Teddy Roosevelt. He didn't realize that this ideology, because he didn't understand the Constitution, was antithetical to the Constitution. He just thought that this was brilliant because almost everybody, the framers even, looked at the masses of people as a bunch of, you know, ignorant problems that they had to protect or keep from getting out of control. So the reason I'm bringing all of this up is because when Dr. Duncan McDougall started exercising this theory, what he was doing, folks, is he was actually going down a path to prove whether a soul existed, whether we have a spiritual component to us or not. And so I want you to understand the magnitude of this. If you understand that we actually have these, these people that are trying to refute God. Darwinism was, you know, starting to rear its head. The Scopes trial was just around the corner. You know, evolution was something that was being prepared and was already being rammed down the throats of our children. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one of the things we already know, and we can prove, is that our own federal government had gone off the rails by the 1870s. And the 1871 Organic Act was really that, I'll just say, the proclamation that America had been under siege by evil forces. And I'll just keep it at that, because when you look at what they did by creating corporations, this is when the federal government, they were already encroaching on the Constitution. And the 14th Amendment, just trying to clean up and trying to ensure that liberties and our liberties were being protected by the states, the 14th Amendment was passed. Now, I've gone through a lot of details in my own research on the 14th Amendment, and I'll get into some more of this later. What I'm trying to do is I'm just trying to create the focusing on this Dr. Duncan McDougall. I'm trying to help you see that what was going on in the United States and in the world today was this transformation of moving away from Christ, the formation of the Antichrist Church, which was basically our U.S. government. I mean, what other formal organization actually formed and started demanding non-Christian doctrine to be taught to its inhabitants of its country? That was the United States government. So what they were doing in creating this, you know, from the Scopes trial and everything else, what they really had created a church, and they actually started creating and regulating religious doctrine to be taught in school, a direct violation of our First Amendment rights because they established a church. Now, they didn't build a church, they didn't appoint anybody, but they themselves, the oligarchs of the robes with Hugo Black, we expose a lot of this, and a lot of people already expose this. There's very few people that will actually go as far as to say that the Antichrist Church was established by the U.S. federal government because they started protecting Satan's doctrine to ensure that all people were to be taught this intricate web of deceit from economics and all of these types of things. It's no wonder why we're in the situation we're in. What they had to start doing was they had to start misinforming us, and they had already initiated the transformation of the Constitution that the original 13th Amendment was to dissolve, and that the 113th Amendment that was passed in 1863, 4, 5, whatever it was, I'd have to pull it up, when the basically the proclamation of ending slavery, that 13th Amendment was passed, then we now have, and see, and I'm going to expose you to a discussion that I'm going to actually be playing because I had an interview with somebody. We see how the United States government was going away from what they were supposed to doing and aggrandizing powers and giving themselves powers that they don't have. That what was happening is that they didn't constitutionally do anything. What they did was they violated the Constitution. The Constitution is still in force today. The Constitution still can be restored. The parties that have to do this are the state legislatures. The problem is people don't do the comprehensive look at, you know, all of the facts and then say, oh, you know what? You're spot on. This is what we need to do. What people do is they end up concocting these cockamamie ideas of, you know, well, we've got to become sovereign citizens. We've got to, you know, form a shadow government. We've got to move away from this. And I'm telling you, folks, there are a lot of people that are doing this. So as a side note, and I'll get into this more, I interviewed a gentleman that's going around and he's helping teach people, you know, how to get involved in basically stepping away from the United States government and the Constitution. Now, they say otherwise, but I don't see this. I can't see this. And as a matter of fact, we'll get into all of that. Let's get back to McDougall. So Dr. McDougall, in the early 1900s, was going to scientifically prove that the spirit is adjoined to the body, that it actually has some mass, and because this is what he was postulating. And as a scientist, he wanted to pursue this and pursue this further. And actually, you know, he started going sideways because in 1901 is when he was actually trying to prove the fact that a human body had a soul and that that spirit had tangible matter to it that, you know, we may not be able to see, but obviously it registered on the scale of weight. Now, it was later that he wanted to make a comparison because he postulated the concept that maybe animals don't have a spiritual essence to them as humans do. Doesn't matter. He was attacked. He was disputed. And they did everything they could to refute this man. So he went into, I'll just say, kind of hiding. They exposed him even before he published his papers and articles. I forget, New York Times or some progressive organization exposed him as a mad scientist. Now, I want you to understand this. If science actually went down this path of proving that the spirit actually contains this mass, then it would make it irrefutable. In other words, it would have stopped the evolution argument from being able to be taught in school. This guy was falling back, forgive the expression, was falling back asswards into a realm of science that was actually going to refute what Satan had already unleashed as the plan forward for everybody to worship and move away from the true spirituality of Christianity. If you understand what I'm trying to say here, this was an exposure to, you know, this person, whether he was moved by Christ or what, to do something. And here's the question. Why is it that nobody has ran with this theory in science ever again that I've heard of, where they've actually gone down this path scientifically and objectively? Because I could see Satan, or I should say people with evil agendas, to actually try to refute this by duplicating it and actually ensuring, like locking the scale at the weight of death so that it doesn't change at all. So that you would know that. You'd say, oh, okay, well, the scale still has it still has the ability to obtain weight, but it's locked at that point. And there's ways that they could have basically created that ruse, but they just didn't even want to open the can of worms. Why? Because that means that maybe somebody else out there would actually venture down this path of trying to do the exact same thing independently from what they would do. And so it's always just better not to let people, even their minds, wander down that path. Because as soon as somebody can scientifically refute what they've done to say, you know what, this is something that's consistent. Now, let me get back to GRism, and let me get back to really, you know, why this is important. Because I believe that, you know, we as humans need to have, you know, aspirations. We need to have, you know, things that help us become healthy, things that help us become more spiritual, and those types of things. And I don't see anything wrong with, and you're more than welcome to use this idiom that I have, that I believe that God created all things. I believe that he created us spiritually. I believe that he created the heavens and the earth, that he controls all matter. And I believe that if he created us spiritually, then there is, you know, he formed us, that it's not just an idea. It is actually a formation and a creation of some form of matter that we may not understand. The fact is that if this is true, that this postulation where this gentleman proved that, then why not use this not as evidence of him, but why not use this in a mental goal or a mental aspiration to say, there's a good likelihood that the more spiritual a person becomes, maybe the greater weight that that person has. Now, my father, I go through this, and I've mentioned this in the goal setting. My father went through a lot of success motivation training and was a very successful man in all of the things he wanted to do for himself. He didn't want to become a rich man. He was very educated. He was very literate. There wasn't a topic that he couldn't delve into, other than maybe computers and computer science, because that was well after his time. But he was competent behind a computer and operating, owning, and, you know, working computers. But anyway, he used to have a sign above his bed that was on the ceiling, so that when he woke up, because he usually slept on his back, he'd wake up and he'd see that little sign. And that sign would say, "Today I'm going to operate at 212 degrees Fahrenheit." Now, to the average person that sees that, they wouldn't understand what that means, but it's a code. It's this little code, because if you understand how much water the body possesses, it's 90-some-odd% water. And if you understand water's maximum potential that it reaches in its state of existence is 212 degrees. In other words, its movement, its maximum essence is 212 degrees, which is steam. So once a water hits that point, it can't get hotter. It's just like once water hits a point of 32 degrees Fahrenheit, it can't get colder, which is why they use water to spray on citrus and those types of things when they have a frost and when things go below 32 degrees to ensure that this crust of ice over the plant and over the fruit will actually protect the fruit from being damaged by the deeper frost. So he had this little sign that says, today I want to operate at 212 degrees. Well, I've always loved that. I always believe that we need to have these little reminders of thinking about what we're going to do. We need to operate at our maximum potential. And so having that sign, you know, I think, you know, is a good sign to have, especially for somebody that had a father that had that sign. But I wanted to add to that. And so I'm going to tell you when we come back what I have created, and I'll kind of give you the example, because remember, I told you before that visualizing is very important to becoming successful. We will be right back after this promo. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so one of the things that I believe is kind of important is that we start understanding, you know, what we resonate with, what will really help us focus, because focus is critical. If you want to be successful, you have to have focus. And so there's a few things that I have kind of used for my focus, because my father used this potential of water mass. And understanding the McDougall and 21 ounces being, or 21 grams being that, you know, the average weight of this person that was dying, if that's the average weight of the soul, and we know it's not because he didn't have a chance to really experiment with this, my goal is to attain 42 grams of spiritual weight, because I'm operating on the premise that the more spiritual we become, the closer we draw to Christ, the closer we are able to do and walk in his path, I believe, because none of these people he was weighing were people that were possibly spiritual giants or anything. They were just victims of some disease or something like that. And it's not that they weren't spiritual. We all have a spirit. But I believe that if somebody exercises their spirituality, they develop that relationship, those types of things, I believe you can actually attain more. It kind of goes down that path, as I said before, regarding the talents, that you can magnify your strength. You can magnify your spiritual strength. And I believe that if you do so, that actually might be measurable. Now, this is completely theoretical. There's no evidence of any of this. But it, if you think about it, why not have a positive slant to something to help you say, if you think, not that you have to believe, if there's a possibility that you can actually obtain a greater mass spiritually, then that must be evidence. Bottom line, if the possibility exists, why not want to increase yourself spiritually? And how do you do that? You read the scriptures, you pray regularly, you constantly live and focus on Him, and you serve others. There's all sorts of ways to do it. But having this little reminder to attain 42 grams in spiritual weight helps you understand that you're trying to magnify yourself spiritually. And so this is all about discipline, because to get there, it requires discipline. To lose weight, it requires discipline. Well, there's a lot of people that do everything they can to try to lose weight, but because of their other infirmities, it actually becomes a catch-22. One of the other things I have, a little clause, I'm just sharing this since I wanted to share this one thing with you. I'll share these other two things. Here's other two little reminders. Everyone must choose one of two pains, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret. So you get to choose what pain you want to have. If you use discipline, it may be painful that you do without, but it's better than to have the regret. That is a greater pain, and I would rather have the pain of discipline. And so the final little snidbit is really a Samuel Adams quote. It is in the interest of tyrants to reduce the people to ignorance and vice, for they cannot live in any country where virtue and knowledge prevail. And so embracing knowledge and embracing virtue and those types of things, as we as a country, and help promoting virtue and knowledge, then we actually move ourselves away from the ability of being ruled by tyrants. So this is why this show is, and I hope it's educational, not entertaining. Anyway, the topic that we want to get into today, and what we'll get into after we go through this show I'm going to tell you about, this two-part show, is republicanism. What is American republicanism? I mean, I hear lots of people constantly yammer about we are to have a republican form of government. Now, this is so important. American republicanism is so important because why? Because there are organizations out there that are still trying to subjugate us or trying to tell us that we fall under the monarchical law. When the Magna Carta was written, that was monarchical law because the king signed it and he agreed to give these rights to the citizens. And then later on, when the king started arbitrarily violating those rights, or the monarchs, then the people rose up and rebelled in the 1680s. And that was the Glorious Revolution that gave them their Bill of Rights. Now, it wasn't but a century later when most of those rights were being trampled on by Britain, and the British people were nowhere near to be found in trying to defend their rights. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were in London together trying to work on a treaty to end the war with the British when they decided to take a little venture into the countryside. And as they were going through the countryside, I don't know if they were on horseback, carriage, or what, they came across the crossroads of where the beginning of that revolution was. And I don't know the name of it, but it was absolutely so historical that they recognized it as soon as they got there. And it wasn't like this little intersection out in the middle of nowhere. It was actually an intersection in a town. And so when they got to that intersection, they basically started preaching to the people that were there, and they kind of caused a ruckus, poking all these Brits in the eye to say, look at all of your rights being trampled on by your own government. And apparently they felt they were in a company of people that wouldn't turn them in because, you know, that would have been, you know, very dangerous because we already know the Britain, we were at war with them and we were trying to create a peace treaty. You just don't go into that country and actually start kicking them in the shins and poking them in the eye. You know, they could easily have turned the tables and said, you're under arrest, and thrown in jail and sent a message saying, send us two more. These guys are under arrest for trying to cause, you know, a riot or for trying to cause an uprising here in Britain. So anyway, as Thomas Jefferson and John Adams kind of did this and kind of poked them in the eye at that point in time, we were actually moving the cause of liberty onto a new scale, onto a new frontier, one where government was going to become limited and defined. So as we look at the Magna Carta was quasi-superseded by the Glorious Bill of Rights. When we created the Declaration of Independence, we formed a complete severance from the crown and from the crown laws. We did not sever ourselves from the fundamentals of the Bill of Rights and the Magna Carta. However, when we formed our first government under the Confederation of Association, we stepped away from all of that. In other words, the Confederation of Association superseded the Bill of Rights, the Glorious Bill of Rights, and it superseded the Magna Carta. They didn't do anything that galvanized the protections of those things other than a few things. One of the things that was galvanized was the right of petition. This is the interesting thing, my friends, because they didn't create a Bill of Rights into the Articles of Association. What they did was they brought forward the right of petition because it was Benjamin Franklin, when they were forming that Articles of Association, he was the one that said, let us not allow them to reign tyranny where we have to pay taxes to pay for it. If we petition government and they fail to redress because we now pay for our government, we don't have a government that is rich or to have riches. They're not to possess riches. They are just a governing entity. And so we have to fund that governing entity. And so if they want to be tyrannical, they want to be arbitrary in how they are to govern us, then, and we petition them to say, you have no right to do this, and they fail to follow our petition or to fix the grievance, then we are no longer obligated to pay for our tyranny. In other words, we defund them. And so it was implemented into the Articles of Association. It was also carried over into the Articles of Confederation. And so the Articles of Confederation actually, you know, embraced the same things that the Articles of Association did, and they brought those forward in an ipso de facto type of way. I don't think that they actually had another meeting, go, what do we want to add to this? They just kind of said, we're going to improve how we work with each other and created the 13 articles of the Articles of Confederation. Well, when we realized that that was going to be a dismal failure, they actually went back to the drawing boards and created a brand new government. All of the framers, if you read the ratification debates, the framers all acknowledged that this was a new government. Therefore, they needed to bring forward these principles that were a part of our heritage. You know, the right of petition, the right of freedom of speech and religious worship, and the right of conscience. All of those things were brought forward in the Bill of Rights. But more importantly, the way the Constitution was written, they could not, well, we'll get into it when we come back.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so if you remember anything that I talk about today, this is probably the most important thing. When the framers created the Constitution, what they did was they created a power of attorney, a limited power of attorney that delegated very specific roles, very specific responsibilities for the federal government, roles for the federal government, very specific powers that they could exercise, and they specified and listed the only type of property that they were allowed to possess. The framers recognized that property was one of the greatest forms of developing wealth. And so they wanted to make sure that the federal government could not be wealthy in property. They wanted to make sure that they only had the necessary property for them to do what they need to do. So when they created this Constitution, it was limited and defined. They didn't need a Bill of Rights, except it did not create the right of petition, even though the right of petition was established into the Articles of Association and carried forward and was a part of the Magna Carta. This new government basically only regulated the federal government of what they could do. It didn't give and it didn't create this responsibility to the right of petition. One of the most important things that we need to have if we're going to hold government accountable and make sure government behaves the way it is supposed to behave, we must have the right of petitioning government for the redress of grievances, which is, I believe, one of the key factors. There's no doubt in my mind, my heart burns when I feel this. One of the key factors of creating declarations or further declaratory restrictions upon the federal government. Remember, I told you the preambles. When we went through the Constitution, there were preambles. There was the first preamble at the very beginning of the Constitution. The second preamble was at the very front end of the listing of enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. There was a little preamble there. The third preamble was in front of the Bill of Rights. And it was a clarification that the Bill of Rights were further declaratory restrictions placed upon the federal government. These restrictions were not placed upon the states. In other words, your Second Amendment rights did not exist if your state did not have them. What applies the Second Amendment rights to the states is the 14th Amendment, period. Or if your state actually applied them in their own constitution. There were plenty of states that actually incorporated. There were a few. As I look at some of the Western constitutions, there were a few that incorporated these protections. Interestingly enough, in Wyoming, the freedom of the press is not in. I mean, there's this word, or I think you find this title, but there's nowhere in the Wyoming Constitution that I found where they guarantee the freedom of the press. Interesting. But nevertheless, the 14th Amendment applies all of those to the states. In other words, the states cannot make any law that abridges the privileges and immunities to the United States citizens, which, by the way, doesn't include the press, because the press is not a citizen. The press is an organization. So what's really important here, folks, that you remember is that we have a very limited and defined power of attorney, that they can't meddle with anything that is not delegated. We added these reservations of further things that they can't even think about. Don't even look at our freedom of religion. Don't even look at our right to bear arms. Don't look at, you know, coming into our personal worlds and extracting, you know, essential information about us. You can't even look at us to spy on us. We have the right in our persons. And so the brilliance of the Bill of Rights really came from being able to use the First Amendment petition. And as a matter of fact, as I tell people, the federal government really wasn't bad. They didn't start behaving bad regarding anything constitutionally except the right of petition. It was the first thing that they violated. I take that back. The Alien and Sedition Acts was obviously a shot across the bow of the Bill of Rights, of the freedom of the press, where the federal government actually said we're going to regulate the press. And it also was a shot across the bow regarding, you know, freedom of speech and so forth. And so the federal government had, you know, had been doing things that were a violation, a direct violation of the Bill of Rights. But over time, and it was in the 1820s, when the one thing in the Bill of Rights that they were directly violating, and nobody held them to it, was the right of petition. The Senate was the first entity to turn its back on the people's petitions for the redress of grievances. Well, what do you mean? Well, so as the abolition movement started growing, more and more people started petitioning and demanding that they, you know, stop allowing slavery to exist, that they needed to end slavery. And they were petitioning government for that. It was Martin Van Buren, the Democratic president, who actually put the gag order in the Senate and on the Senate floor regarding the abolition petitions. We're not to discuss it. We will no longer debate this issue. It is a state's right. And at that point, my friends, that is where they actually turned their backs. And this is where America basically galvanized the necessity of a civil war. So as we kind of look at, you know, the Constitution and these rights and these restrictions and so forth, the one thing that I want to impress upon you is the right of petition, and how the right of petition has been viewed as the biggest problem. Now, I don't have a lot of time left. It's viewed the biggest problem by those evildoers who want to silence us. And so that's one of the reasons why it's not taught in school, and that's one of the reasons why it is the most effective educational tool. It is what Martin Luther used, and as we start learning more about this, it becomes our primary weapon. This is something that I am absolutely addressing in my Convention of States argument in my Constitutional Minutes. I don't have time to get into this. What I want to get into is what we're going to be talking about tomorrow, and in tomorrow's episode, what we're going to cover, I'm going to be talking to a gentleman by the name of Bill Hermiston out of Missouri, and he is an advocate for the jural assemblies. Now, the Jural Assemblies is an assembly that is being formed in many states. If you go out and you look at and you search for Jural Assemblies, you'll find an Oklahoma Jural Assembly. You'll find, you know, several states that have created Jural Assemblies. What they're doing, and we'll get into this more, but what they're doing is they're organizing people as a separate entity from the U.S. Constitution and the citizens of the U.S. and the U.S. Constitution. Now, I don't think these guys really know, or maybe they don't know, so I'm going to have a conversation, but I need to examine these articles and so forth. And oh, by the way, I want to give you the advantage over, you know, even what I had when I actually had this interview. So prior to my interview, I didn't even know about this website. And so what I want to do is just let you go and check this out. The website is nationalassembly.net. It's national-assembly.net. I need you to look at this and go through this. If you actually go to the resources button at the very top where you can expand on things, it'll create a little, you know, open up window underneath. Go to the handbook. Inside this handbook, there's all sorts of information. What I would ask you to do so that you can get smart on this is go through this. They talk about very specific documentation that you need to understand how to set up an assembly and what these assemblies are. Please read these with open eyes, because I want you to actually understand, is this an organization that is creating a shadow government, or is this an organization that is working to restore our hybrid constitutional republic that still exists? It is operating out, you know, at this monster is kind of driving the car, but it still exists. So here's the question. What are they doing? What are they actually helping you do here? I'll let you answer that. We will have that interview in our next episode. Now, American republicanism is a complete different paradigm than what republicanism is throughout the world. Republicanism throughout the world is a representative government based on the rule of law, and the representatives, or the representation, is the people. In other words, republicanism is a democratic form of government that that uses representation, a democracy within representation, and the rule of law. When we get into what ended up happening in the Connecticut Compromise in establishing our Constitution and why we have bicameral legislative bodies both at the federal level and at the state level, this should help you understand what type or how we have redefined America, republicanism in America, why American republicanism is a unique beast compared to republicanism in any other country, because no other country recognizes their government as sovereign. They all believe that they want all the power themselves. I mean, that's the selfish thing to do. The hardest thing to do is to delegate and give power to somebody else. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we're going to dive into this, and you're going to love our next two episodes. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort.
We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.